was long, I agree, and I was wondering if it was too long. And then the challenge is open-ended questions, of course, is you can go in forever if you really wanted to.
I think it brought a lot of information out. It took me a long time too. There were questions where it was almost like there was in my mind several ways to answer it.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of like,
what
is Tim Butterfield's mind thinking? You know, it was like, maybe I got it, but maybe I didn't.
He was like, you're overthinking this. This is not as complicated as you're... Because I think some of the questions were kind of on the vaguer end, so I think it opened up for...
But I think maybe that was your point.
This brings up the same point with the challenge of the split class, which was a great challenge to have, because it would get a whole bunch of people different backgrounds together to learn, and learning is the objective, right? So you guys have more background because you're already in graduate school than the undergrads do, usually, right? So I expect that there'd be more depth probably from you guys in some questions compared to other ones from undergrad students, because they may not have that depth of knowledge from graduate school, and that's fine, because then we can compare, and they can compare, and you can all chat, and all kinds of questions.
Can you go over the stress and force one? Because I didn't answer that, because I had no idea what you were going to talk about. I would love to know.
Ken mentioned it one day in class, and I'm gonna I'll go over it right now for you.
Or someone who is.
I'll go for you.
I
do want to remind you before we continue on. Thanks for that, by the way. That's helpful. That's good to know. And as Robin and I mentioned before, again, the learning is the objective. So I think it's good to see the variety of answers that are on there. Anyways, so Monday, I believe. Monday we'll go over the exam, okay?
Oh.
And on Monday we will have you all come up and answer a question, present a question for us, right? A question, 1, 2, 2, 4, 13, question and a quarter, something like that. Okay? So, and today, to make it more fun, we're just going to suck the number out of a hat. How's that? They're not as excited about it as we are.
Sounds like fun.
And then we can discuss those questions in more detail and see where it goes from there. Monday is your article summary due, right? And we'll talk about the research paper on Monday as well. I think that covered up all the... I feel this side of the class over here is underrepresented by the art presence, so I keep walking over here because I feel bad even though it's over there. So I want your other side of your neck to get a workout. So today, there's no question. Oh, stress.
I mean, if we're going over that one.
No, just real quick. It's going to bother me for years, isn't it?
I don't know if I'd sleep this weekend.
Stress. Real stress.
I'm going to get a t-shirt made that has Sigma on it. That's engineering stress. Oh, I had a joke last night. 2 o'clock in the morning, I came up with a joke about stress. Oh, damn it.
That's what the second beer will do.
Yeah, right. No, anyway, I had a t-shirt that had engineering on it that said stress something. Anyway, stress is... force per cross-sectional area? Okay.
Is that all you're
going to put? Nope. So here's one of the analogies for you. So you have a tissue response to a load, whatever load that might be. And you take a tissue and you disperse that load over the area of a 1 centimeter radius, or you disperse that load over a 1 meter radius. Now, which one's going to have more of an impact on that tissue and make that tissue respond in a more dramatic way?
Smaller area.
Would you rather get stuck with a hypodermic needle or a pencil? I mean, with a certain load, a pencil's not going to go through your skin, but the needle always will, right? Because the surface area is so much smaller, the stress is greater, right? So force over area, Newtons over square millimeters of Pascal. Blaise Pascal came up with pressure and stress. And because we don't have square meters in our tissues, we have to look at megapascals, which is a newton over a square millimeter. So most of the literature you'll see for anything in tissues, it's going to be a megapascal. So newton over millimeter squared. That's probably the best way to ever put your data if you have stress data. Then there's engineering stress and true stress, which the only time we'll talk about that probably when we get to tendons and tissues, more in failure. If we talk about injury and failure at all, we'll talk about how stress is measured and how it's reported in the literature, because engineering stress and true stress are different things depending on your structure. Ductile tissues, brittle tissues. Do you want brittle bones or ductile bones? Which would you rather have, brittle or ductile? All we know is brittle sounds bad, right? So just choose ductile. So when you pull on it, it bends and it deforms a little bit. Brittle just snaps in half. Right? So you apply a load and you have this elongation or compression and the tissue just fails. That's a brittle tissue. For instance, if you have stress and strain, you have a curve. Tissue that fails at that strain, at that stress, that would be a brittle tissue. You'll see that in osteoporosis.
That's what I originally started answering the question with. I drew the stress strain curve, blah, blah, blah. And then I was
not
like,
a bad place to start.
Right, but then I didn't know where to go from there. I was like, what does this have to do with why we use the term stress instead of force? And then I just didn't answer it clearly. So it's just because.
So stress is force divided by area. That basically means this is a normalized curve. That means you can compare structures of different sizes with stress and strain as well. And if it normalized curve, then this gives you the true material properties of the tissue. Because you're normalizing, because cross-sectional area will always influence the stress of the tissue. But you can't compare the structure of the material properties of what it's made out of if they all have different cross-sectional areas. So you do a stress-strain curve, then you can talk about material properties. If you just had a force elongation curve, change in length curve, it would look very similar to that one, which you may have a brittle tissue that fails. But because it's not normalized cross-sectional area, this gives you the structural properties. So this is related to stress and strain. But if you have force elongation, you really can't compare tissues of different sizes to different tissues. You can't talk about the material it's made out of, but you can talk about the structure of it. If you have stress strain, you can talk about the material it's made out of. And that's where if you have tendons from aged and tendons from young, you stress strain, and they're different because of the material, not because of the size.
But like, what about if you just hear the term specific force? What would be the difference between that?
So yeah, if you're talking about now about force production or force divided by the area, the cross-sectional area, yeah. Not much except for what their definitions are. Yeah. It's basically the same thing, except you're talking about an autobaric produced force internally that you want to normalize to compare across different size muscle sections or different species, whatever it might be, right? But you're not pulling it to failure. Otherwise, it would be exactly the same thing.
Talking about my structural properties, I think the question set muscle type or something like that. So I think
why is stress more relevant to muscle?
And I just focused on the area because they have various sizes.
And that's absolutely fine. Yeah. I know we had
because they should all have the same structural properties, right? I mean, some might have more.
Yeah.
You seem like there's no real way to know that without
of what?
No. Together,
yeah, you don't know. That's true. And so, you know, when you're doing stress and strain for muscle tissue to failure, for instance, and you're doing eccentric contraction, you're pulling it to failure. All you're doing then is looking at the slope of the curves, the energy absorbed before failure, the length at which it fails before failure. Right? And so, that becomes stress strain. You're normalizing them so you can compare them.
But you can also do a force elongation curve, right? But that's just going to tell you one's going to fail if it produces more force, probably because it's bigger. So it doesn't help. If that makes sense. So that was one of those questions at the end. I'm going, man, I had like a whole bunch there, and I'm going, everyone was, you know, not quite, we hadn't talked about it a whole lot. So I was like, so I threw that one on there just really to see how you all did at that point in time more than anything else. But that's okay.
I mean, really,
it's not going to be held against you really in any way because we're having a conversation about it. Again, if you're worried about the answer to these questions, again, we're more concerned about learning than it is about, you know, this X, Y, and Z, discrete numbers, move on. We're more just going to keep on revisiting these things and make sure that you get these concepts right. So don't worry about those things right now. We'll let you know if you have to start worrying about things. Okay. Okay. So I wanted to talk today about function, right? We've talked briefly about force length. We talked briefly about force velocity. We talked briefly about muscle, how it functions, the cross-bridge cycle with Dr. Campbell. And moving well further up the scale of this hierarchical structure, right? We talked about the sarcomere. We talked about the cell, but we haven't talked about how this relates to movement, what it means for you. Your muscles and you should be the name of this class. Okay? So one of the questions that we had, I wanted to show you this frog real quick, show you a couple of fun videos, because everybody likes good movies in the morning. And then I want to talk about A.B. Hill, who was another Nobel laureate in muscle. And I know we had a couple of, we talked briefly about force velocity the last couple of weeks, and we touched on it with respect to the fiber typing on the exam. I want to go over it more today because of people's interest in it, and because I think if you have a more in-depth understanding of it, I think it'll help understand how we function in vivo all the time and how we can optimize it, perhaps. Right? So we wanted to study frogs because frogs jump far. That's really the only reason we wanted to study a frog. 1990, Lutz and Rome had a publication in Science, and anybody that knows publication, once their citations, their impact factors increased. Science is one of the most prestigious journals in the world, right? I don't even know what its impact factor is up to now. 40-something, maybe? Who knows? But Nature and Science are two of the most prestigious journals in the world. If you get published there, you can autograph it for people and they'll be happy. That's what it amounts to. So they had a paper in Science in 1990 that basically said, we think we know why frogs can jump really far, and they never made a frog jump. Right? So it's one of those mathematical modeling assumptions, X, Y, and Z, and the paper was so full of assumptions, but nobody had ever done it before, so it winds up in Science. And we said, well, we can measure a frog jumping. Why wouldn't we measure a frog jumping? Right? Because, and people have been in muscle mechanics, you can't answer this question, sure, you know the answer, but anybody else? You can if you want to. Know what animal on the planet jumps the farthest for its mass?
A flea.
Damn fleas. Except for the basis for the Red Hot Chili Peppers, he's cool. So fleas. Fleas don't have long muscles, right? So how does a flea jump so far? He takes advantage of a tendon called a resilin pad. Do flies have resilin pads as well? So it was first identified as a big elastic rubber band protein in the wings of some insects that allowed them to absorb energy and then keep flying without having to use their muscles so much, right? And the reason why we don't get exhausted walking over to Starbucks is because we have long Achilles tendons that absorb energy and give it back to us, so our muscles don't have to constantly work cycle after cycle after cycle running out of ATP. We have tendons that give us elastic storage of energy. But frogs don't have resilin pads. They don't get to dig their spiky little claws that hurt into the dog's skin and push themselves back, ratcheting almost like a little cog with a ratchet, stretching out this pad, and then click, boing, and away they go. Tumble, ass over tea kettle, to wherever they land, without a whole lot of aiming, because they don't really care. And they keep on going. But it's just a rubber band, right? It's not really even muscle. The muscle they do use is to push themselves back, to click that thing, and then take off. Frogs don't have that. And frogs don't do counter-movement jumps. You know, one of the more difficult things to do is see how far you can jump from a squatted, from a position in which you don't get to do a stretch and then jump. You just jump, or you jump from a sitting position. What's that called? Where you sit, then you jump. Because it's more difficult to do. There's one where you sit in the chair, so you're not taking advantage of the stretch.
From a chair. Never chair.
Okay. So you sit with 90 degrees, so you're not taking advantage of the eccentric contraction prior to the concentric contraction, so you're not loading your tendons, right? So you're not taking that elastic energy and using it for your advantage, you just jump. And it's more difficult to do. Go home and try it, I promise. It's not easy to do. Frogs don't do that, but they still jump really far. So what we did was, this is a custom-made little force plate for frog, a frog force plate. And we instrumented these frogs with sonomicrometry, so that in the semitendinosus muscle of the frog, we put sonomicrometry, which is a technology to measure the real-time distance changes in muscle fascicles. We put a buccal force transducer on the tendon of a frog, so we can get real force measurement in frog. And then we put EMG electrodes in the muscle, so we can see when it was activated and just how much it would be activated. So there's a lot of hardware in this little frog. And you see all the wires are coming out right here. This frog, he's just waking up, he's happy, and he's on the force plate, so we'll have ground reaction forces as well. But what we wanted to do this for was to measure the power of one muscle during jumping, and the mechanics and kinematics of jumping with a frog. And see if Lutz and Rome from 1990 and their science paper are close to being correct. I think it published in Science for that. We thought it published in real life science for this. Didn't happen, but try. So, let's talk about A.D. Hill for a second. I just want to show you a picture. Okay, show the movie.
Yeah.
Sorry. Let me give you the take-home message next week, but I guess I can show you the movies. Nothing else. So, they don't jump, by the way. Predators, the predator-prey relationship in the world is kind of fun. Which, if you ever watch white-tailed deer with dogs or wolves or coyotes, it's really interesting. Or elk in the Yosemite National Park with wolves trotting around and elk just staying there, but they don't care because they don't really want to move. Because once they move, they know that you're going to see them and eat them. Right now, I'm not going to eat the frog by any means, but they think you are. There it is. So we yelled at them, we clapped our hands, sang them songs, flicked their butt, and it wasn't until you made the sound of an owl that they jumped. Does that make sense? So a whole bunch of people are going, ooh, it's great. And so I only have two of the videos here today, but this is I find this fascinating that these guys jump so far. But when he comes back down, watch his knees and his body position, and you won't see him go. Right? He pretty much just sits there, takes off, and goes really far for his mats. And then, once he does that...
Are we supposed to be able to see where
you're... So, I'm watching some really cool movies over here. Thanks for that, Kate. You let me go on that long.
Tim, who was this presentation for originally that you had to delineate what the frog is? Who was this made for?
Oh, God. Tough crowd, you know? So why isn't that playing?
Is it not following your screen?
I think they
I'm over here watching videos, everything else. There we go. Maybe this time? My computer's been doing all kinds of weird things for days. There we go. Hey, you might recognize this. This is a frog jumping off a force plate. Look, there he goes.
Wow.
Now watch how he lands. You won't quite see how he lands because he jumps out of frame, but he lands on their face every single time. I think their chins are made for landing. Because every single one of them lands in their face. So this was not quite as good. This one I have, so you can see how he jumps and lands from afar and how far he jumps. The other one is up close, more up close than this one, so you'll see better the... there he goes, his face. See the shadow in the background. I love the shadow in the background.
Every time.
And this is why I love muscle architecture and internal function. I mean, if you had levers that big on your lower extremity, you know, technically you could produce a lot of really large moment because you'd have a really long lever, but your muscle would have to be completely redesigned to be able to do that, to be able to use that lever to your advantage. Otherwise, you're walking around like a person with skis on their feet all the time, and it's a pain in the butt, probably, right? But these guys take advantage of that pretty well. Here's a... This will just be a little bit closer up, I think. And he goes a little bit more vertical. Now, the parabolic effect of jumping in frogs, I don't think they think about this when they actually jump.
Straight up.
Yeah, those legs they stick. But so again, what I said a minute ago when you guys weren't watching the same movie I was, you can watch his knees and his body and see how he doesn't, like I said, he does not do a counter movement. He doesn't really move at all until he just starts pushing off with his feet. We don't have 3D. His knees may come out from his body a little bit, but not a lot.
You get a lot of EMG activity right before they're jumping.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Just like building up in them.
Yep. Yep, exactly. So the results from this I'll show you next week once we talk about a couple things. One's more stress strain, tendons, and muscle. Because now, you know, I want to talk about E.B. Hill, but also how the tendon that's attached in series with muscle. And mechanically, if it has something in series with muscle, it has to share the force with muscle. Yet the tendon assists you in producing, not producing force, it stores the energy and it gives it back to you. So, which I think is fascinating. So we can do that. So, A.B. Hill. Anybody know A.B. Hill? Personally, he's not around before. Know of A.B. Hill? Adrian Vivian Hill. Won the Nobel Prize in 1922 in physiology and medicine. He's British, as is Sir Andrew Huxley. I don't think he's a Sir A.B. Hill.
How do you become a sir?
He used to be really, really awesome.
Oh.
And you get knighted.
Right? Oh, you get knighted.
By the queen.
Elton John.
Sir.
Elton John.
That happens
on first. See? So A.B. Hill wanted to study...
Okay.
A.B. Hill studied... Okay. What he got his Nobel Prize for was thermodynamics of muscle contraction. There's a heat produced when a muscle contracts, right? You got to consider this was 1910, 1918, 1919. And everyone knew that there was an effect of heat production in muscle when it contracted, but nobody understood why. Adenosine triphosphate wasn't even a word at the time. There was phosphocreatine bonds. People knew about high phosphate energy bonds, but nobody knew exactly what the thing was going on in muscle, and even how muscle contracted. There was articular theories and these other theories about lactic acid, and there was one theory that when you saw light and dark bands under a microscope, and because they changed... Henson thought that when they changed, it's because one side pushed fluid and the other side made it expand, and that was the expansion model of fluid contraction in muscle. But still nobody could understand why heat was produced. So A.B. Hill devoted his research career to that. Otto Meyerhoff helped him and gave him his first thermopile. A thermopile is basically still used today. And this is 1918, 1919, and the instruments that A.B. Hill was creating and using are still used today. That's how sensitive they were. So thermopile, what he wanted to do was he wanted to take your frog, right? Angry frog. And I put that frog in. No, I'll give him a big foot.
It's
coming at you. And he wanted to use the plantaris muscle of a frog. But he couldn't use it in the frog, right, back then. So he designed this, what's called a thermopile. A thermopile, first, is a bath that has circulating water around it that keeps it at a certain temperature, right? Then it has place for a hook, and a place for another hook attached to a motor. So he would take his fiber out of the frog, secure it appropriately, and then he would fill the bath with ringer solution, Krebs solution. And you'd have a tissue taken out of a living organism about 15 minutes prior in a bath to keep it happy, that he can keep it at temperature because of that bath that goes around it. And within it was a series of conductive elements. And if you look down at them, in his paper, they look like this, right? Looks like a heating pad you get. Looks like something from a heating pad that you would just want to heat a blanket with or something of the sort. Except instead of heating with it, he was recording from it. And the thing was so sensitive in 1919 that he could record a temperature of 00015 degrees Celsius. And that's a really specific heat measuring device. Right? Now, he used frog fibers because you got to imagine that the technology and the things they had back then weren't as good as we have now. So it took a lot longer, many times, to get data. Because you didn't hit a computer control key and have data get collected. You had to do everything manually. You had chart recorders, you had ink to change, you had paper that would get jammed. All these things they had to do. So frog muscle fiber lasts a lot longer than mammalian muscle fibers do. And he knew that. So he kept the water bath at 0 degrees. Wouldn't freeze because there's solutes in there. 0 degrees, that would make that muscle last for almost an entire day. Right? You could use that fiber over and over again. It would fatigue, but it would come back. Right? It wouldn't have this constant drop in force like a mammalian muscle would. Ken talked last week about the difference between the psoas and the plantaris muscles. Right? All muscles are different. Choose your model because some are better than others. The amphibian muscle for these types of experiments, you can keep them around for hours in a day. Right. Tortoise muscle was used a lot too back in the day because it also has those same amphibian properties, right? So he had his fiber in a bath, and he had a postdoc named Wallace O'Fenn. Wallace O'Fenn, the one thing Wallace O'Fenn got to put into literature that still sticks around today is called the Fenn effect. The Fenn effect of muscle is something that people still talk about. The Fenn effect is that heat is produced when muscle contracts. The challenge with Wallace O'Fenn was he hated math, even back in 1919, when everybody liked math back in the day. But he didn't, he wasn't good at it, and he could not formulate the equation that went along with his effect. Therefore, he gets known as the guy who had the Fenn effect that worked as a postdoc in A.B. Hill's lab, and A.B. Hill gets a Nobel Prize. As it is, math makes the world go round, that's the moral of the story. When the Nobel Prize you're in math, that might be a moral of the story. So, did you ever wonder where those big robes come from for academia, by the way? You know, they're made out of wool, right? I mean, back in the day, those things look like you wouldn't want to wear it often. But back in the day, 1919, 1910, in Britain, you know, it got humid and cold in the wintertime. All the buildings were made out of stone. They had fireplaces in the corner. No central air in the summer. No central heating in the winter, right? So it's cold there. Those guys would wear those robes in their chambers while they wrote and read and were doing academic, scientific-y things, right? So they actually wore them all around all the time. That is because it was cold, and the reason why it was cold in A.B. Hill's basement was because it was made out of stone. He lived in England. So A.B. Hill, not only did he make this really sensitive device that he used to collect these data in 1919, 1920, he did it in the basement of his own house, right?
He did it at Hogwarts.
Huh?
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. In the basement of his own house, he did his experiment.
Well, right.
In fact, there's something I read last night. You can find, these guys wrote differently back in the old days. I mean, Huxley's paper, and I put A.B. Hill's paper up there for you, too, if you want to read it. It's a fantastic paper. It goes on three different sections, the creation of his thermopile, the hypothesis behind heat exchange, and then his results. Right? And they just wax rhapsodic for days. I mean, if you wrote the way they wrote back then, your reviewer would kick your paper back to you and tell you you can't publish there because shut the hell up and just put some science in it, please. These guys talk about fun stuff. You can go online and find old editions of the proceedings of the Royal Society of London. And one of them talked about Wallace O. Fenn in the basement of A.V. Hill's house. And now, then he wrote, somebody called me. I hustled upstairs. Just went, put it in a paper. Theodore Huff, 1902, talked about how one of the subjects smoked a cigar while he waited for his experiment. I'm like, was that relevant to the science? No, but it was fun, right? It made it more fun to read and made it like, oh, it's science for everybody. It's kind of just cool. Now it's just science-y. Kind of miss the old days. I wasn't there myself, but I liked reading. So in the basement of his own house, because it was so cold in the basement of his own house, it helped keep that at 0 degrees all the time, right? Because, again, they didn't have air conditioning or cooling devices. They had ice baths and water, and he had to maintain that thing at 0 degrees manually with ice and water, right? So then he did water considered to be, probably just by me, but considered to be two of the most elegantly simple and coolest experiments you could possibly do with a thermopile in the basement of your own house of the period. And that is trying to measure the output of heat from a muscle in two different instances. Basically what he did one experiment in which he kept the load constant, and then did another one. Which he kept the distance constant. And I like talking about A.V. Hill because, especially the people that are getting into science and going to start a science career or are in the process of starting your own experiments, I say it's an elegantly simple experiment because he controlled the two most important variables you could possibly control when it comes to looking at muscle function. And you're going to contract this little muscle. And he actually controlled the load, so that is taken out of the equation. And he controlled the distance that it shortens, took that out of the equation. There's not a whole lot left. So he organized these things really, really well, did a nice series of experiments, and came up with his still today used equation, the Hill equation, for muscle. So keeping the load constant, I don't remember, sorry, what that load was, did a series of experiments with some fibers, and he had them in the thermopile bath, and he put a galvanic stimulator in there, and he contracted them so that they would produce a force and it would shorten. Contraction means to shorten. And in shortening, he had a device in which he would try to keep that load constant. So load didn't change, and the first one would contract, and it had this little rise in heat. So when the muscle first starts to contract, there's a heat production that's produced from that little fiber. And then became steady. And that was just a short, we'll call it 1 millimeter, shortening. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but for our purposes, it was a very short shortening. And then after it shortened that distance, this is isometric, right? So this right here is all isometric. This right here is a shortening section. The next one, he let shorten double the distance, so let's say 2 millimeters. Okay. And that shortened, had the exact same slope, and then when it got done, it had the exact same slope as the first one. So the difference here is this extra bit of heat from the shortening of 2 millimeters. But then this again is ISO. It looks almost exactly the same as the one before. And he did this for a few more fibers. I think you're getting the idea of what's going to happen. So what he noticed was there was an additional amount of heat that was released from the muscle every time it shortened a little bit further. But when that muscle was held isometric and contracted in the dish without being allowed to shorten, it produced the same heat every time. So the heat amount was a little bit more when it got shorter, but the rate at which it produced force, and the rate is the slope of this line, is the same across all of them, right? So there's a moment where A.B. Hill goes from measuring the heat and then going to do the calculations for rate. Remember that in any of these figures, the slope of the line is rate. Okay? So the change in Y compared to the change in X is going to be the slope of that line, and that's rate of anything. So I have a displacement graph, take the slope, it's velocity. Change in distance for change in time. So from that, what he concluded was that the distance of shortening was imperatively important when it comes to the heat produced in muscle. And distance in anything is always going to be an X. Well, we like to make it X's, just to make it whatever you want for any kind of a constant. But X is distance. We'll do that where there's a highlighted section. Now, we talked about normalization and stress a little bit in the class, right? You want to be able to compare the force of, let's say I have two muscle fibers. One is this big, and one is this big. We can make an assumption that this fiber will produce more force than that one, right? Just because it's thicker. Probably has more cross bridges, has more myosin, has more parallel structures that are going to be additive. Therefore, this one's probably going to produce more force. So we can't compare between them, right? Unless we normalize them to something, and that would be cross-sectional area. A.B. Hill recognized this. When he was doing this, he recognized the fact that bigger fibers were producing more heat than smaller fibers. Even though these slopes were the same, he normalized them to something called a constant A. And that is simply a constant that's going to normalize your structures to the cross-sectional area. So this is, I'll put cross-sectional area. This is distance. Now he did a lot of calculations to figure out what that constant is numerically. He plotted some of the data and took the slope of that line, and that was what he used for his constant. But he came up with that constant not off the top of his head. I mean, he actually did some calculations to get that. So that's the constant. It normalizes your heat for the distance that it shortens based on the size of the fiber. Okay. He also did a second set of experiments in which, when he kept the distance constant, he started off with, again, a contraction, and again, when it first contracted, get a good rate of heat production when the tissue starts to shorten. And then after that, you have this one isometric. This is still the isometric one to compare to, right? Then he used grams. Maybe he didn't have 32 grams lying around the house that day. I don't know. But use 31.9 grams. And what he found was there was rapid heat production, and then when the muscle tried to contract and shorten against 31.9 grams, it was I'm going to make that a little bit bigger because I'm going to have to kind of call the dots here in a second, but how would you do that? We'll make it this way. There was a greater heat production, there's a greater slope being produced, but it was still greater than compared to isometric. He then started using lighter and lighter loads. These are the numbers I don't have off the top of my head because 31.9 was the only one that caught my eye because it was just off. Let's say 20. That one would do similar beginning, but then it had a greater slope. And the lighter he made the load, the greater the rate of heat production. You're going to get mad at me now, but don't move that out to there. Something like that. And then once they all got to the same distance that they were shortening, because this was held constant, they all did this. They all became isometric at that distance and produced the same amount of heat at the same rate at that distance. From those set of data came the second most used equation in muscle mechanics, muscle physiology that I know of, which is the Hill equation in 1919-1920. So what you'll notice here, there's two very interesting things when you control one of those variables, is that you move against a heavy load, you're going to have heat produced, it's going to take longer to do, than if you move against a shortened load at the same distance. Your rate of heat production is going to be a lot faster. But when you get to the same distance and hold it there, you aren't producing any extra heat compared to the heavy load. You produce the same amount of heat every single time. The rate at which it's produced is what's different. Because these all get to the same place when you hold distance constant. Now, if you let it shorten further, it probably all would have shortened up here, but they still would have been at the same place. Now keep in mind that in 1919, Huxley was still working on neurons. Huxley hadn't even formulated this cross-bridge theory yet that Dr. Campbell showed us last week. Nobody knew there were cross-bridges. Nobody knew there was ATP. Nobody knew how muscle contracted. So he didn't have the luxury of saying, oh, this is obviously cross-bridges doing this. This is really cool. One ATP is used for every cycle of cross-bridges. What's going on? He didn't have that luxury. A.F. Huxley had the luxury of using A.B. Hill's data to formulate his cross-bridge theory. And he cites A.B. Hill and A.B. Hill's findings throughout the entire paper from 1957.
I don't understand, so at like 31.9 grams and 25 grams, we're exponentially contracting against those loads. Why is the heat production greater in the heavier load?
This is not, no, he's letting it shorten, right? So this is starting at, maybe your fiber here is maybe 10 millimeters long, and then that's the resting length. He's normalizing this to a resting length. And then as it shortens, it's probably here. These are all distance constant, so I don't know what distance it was. Let's call it 3 millimeters. So it's not that there's more heat. It's that the rate of this heat is greater. So the slope of this line represents the rate at which heat, because heat is on this y-axis. This is the same amount of heat.
Yeah. So what? Why is it when it becomes an isometric contraction that rate isn't still great?
So the slope of this line is probably the same as this one. It should be the same as this one, which is very, 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 very small. Because when you think about the cycling of what we know now, is that to break the bond of a myosin-actin interaction, ATP has to be bound into the crossbridge, the S1 fragment of the crossbridge. When the myosin head accepts that ATP, it changes the conformation of that crossbridge and it lets go of actin, right? Then it hydrolyzes the actin, the ATP, goes through its cycle producing force. So every single Crossbridge cycle is only using one ATP. Remember the other day when Ken showed Huxley's model and drew the squares on the F and G? The rate probability of attachment and detachment during an isometric contraction is far less than when things start to move. So one thing that made application of this to cross-bridge theory somewhat difficult in the beginning was everyone assumed that the actin and the myosin and the cross-bridges were rigid rods, inextensible rigid rods. So if a rigid rod came down and grabbed onto actin isometrically and tried to pull, it couldn't pull because it's isometric. Therefore, nothing would happen. Well, it's not the case because you have connective tissue in these tendons. The cross bridges have a spring. They're compliant. The filaments are compliant. A lot of these cross bridges are cycling and are able to go through that 5-nanometer stroke and detach. But the number of them that are doing it is much less than when you start to move. Therefore, the ATP getting broken down is less isometrically than it is during a moving contraction. So the rate is less than it is when you're actually moving.
But they are contracting isometrically against different
loads. No, they're contracting concentrically here until they get to their distance. So this is controlled as a constant meant between the experiments. The length that they're allowed to shorten is controlled. So they're starting off with a concentric contraction, they're shortening, and when they get to that length, then they're held isometrically.
Yeah.
So this is the isometric part.
Contraction doesn't matter what the load is, because either way you're
matching. I don't know. No, so the concept of the weight makes sense to me. I guess, maybe this might just be my lack of understanding this like single fiber experience, but like in a human, like if they're isometrically contracting against a greater load, it will be utilizing more ATP to support a greater load.
Ah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So keep in mind that this is a 100% supramaximal stimulation, right? So this isn't graded force production in humans and motor unit recruitment, because that's what you're getting at now. So I get what you're saying. So in humans, we put Emily on the Biodex, Kate in the Biodex, you in the Biodex, and have you do a heavy load, maximal heavy load. We make an assumption that you have either a choice of producing the load at which you produce a force to hold it stable or try to overpower the system. And depending on what you're going to do, you're going to use more motor units and more ATP. These guys have a platinum electrode with an electrical voltage charge going in that's making every single fiber depolarize, and everyone wants to produce force. So calcium is being footed into the whole thing 100% every single time. Right? So irrespective of the load, they're still working supermaximally every time. Okay. And that's how that's controlled. Sorry. Good question. That's I got it. Okay.
So what he wants us to get is that the rate of heat production is dependent on the load.
That's exactly what he doesn't say.
What?
No. It's a great question because that is the only that's the one thing about the paper that gets somewhat confusing. In which he makes this miraculous conclusion and says that even though it's dependent upon load and dependent upon distance is the most important thing.
Okay.
Because this is why. Because the amount of heat produced with the loads is still the same. The rate's different. So distance gives you different amounts of heat. But no, I thought exactly the same thing. Every time I go back and read this paper, I still think the same thing, and I keep forgetting that that's the most important thing is the distance. Right. But load only has an impact because of the rate of heat rate, if you keep the distance constant. Between these two experiments, do we all agree that when you put a force applied to a structure and you move it a certain distance x, that's called work, mechanical work? So this is basically work. This is basically distance. Does
So he formulated one side of his equation to be work plus distance as the first side of his equation.
And yes, that is a P. And I wrote it that way because I wanted to make sure I tell you something else interesting about the old days. When you read a muscle paper and it has a P in it, and you'll see the Hill equation with a P in it for force, is because back in the old days, they recorded force as pounds. And that's why force has a P. People nowadays put an F in there as well, but I did a P just like to remind you that that's why they use P's. Don't be surprised by that. So that is the heat produced, according to A.B. Hill, 1920, in muscle. It's work plus the distance that it shortens, and then you have to just correct it with that that constant to keep your cross-sectional areas normalized so you can compare fiber to fiber. Is that cool? If it's not cool, let me know. I'm happy to talk with this forever. Of course, an equation, right? You have to have an equal sign, two sides to it. You also have another equation on this side, which I'm going to put first, and I'm going to tell you what it is afterwards. Negative B times the difference between P and P naught. P sub zero. I call these knots, so I call it P naught. P sub zero takes too long to say. P naught's easy. Yeah, minus negative B times P minus P naught. These two constants I told you about, A and B, were slopes of lines that he used to... He basically took his data on distance, did this with it, put rate of heat and distance shortened, and lo and behold, it was a really nice relationship like that. So the rate of heat production over the distance that shortened was a linear relationship, a nicely linear relationship, and the slope of that line became A. Did the same thing with work. Sorry, not work. Yes. Load. And it's a negative relationship. Higher loads, lower rate. That became the slope of B, which was negative, because it's negative slope. That's why the negative came in there. I don't want to just throw out letters and you don't know where they come from. So when he sloped those were his two normalizing constants. So now he can compare fiber to fiber to fiber to fiber. All right. And then P minus P naught is basically looking at the difference between constant of contraction and isometric contraction. P naught is an isometric contraction. P naught is isometric. And P is a concentric contraction. So already by these data, we know that the rate of heat production here is greater than the rate of heat production here. Right? By the slopes of these lines. Isometric rate. Very shallow, very small slope, very low rate. Concentric forces produce greater rates of heat. So that's it. That's Hill's equation, which I'm just going to change around a little bit to get to the point that you can prove it for a second. But that is Hill's equation from those two experiments. So you'll hear often about models of muscle. There's a lot more to this paper. You can imagine it's 56. some pages long, I think it is, with three parts in it. And on those pages, each one of them, it's like a book, so each page, you photocopy it, and then you have a page to page on each side. You flip over, it's page to page, and the print's really small. Because it was 1932, 38. So, when we talk about models of muscle, it's trying to understand how it contracts. A.B. Hill's cross bridge model is modeled as these cross bridges that have a probability of attaching and pulling force. And Hill's model is basically this, in which you have a contractile element producing force and heat in series with some elastic elements and tendons and how those things relate to each other, which we aren't going to talk about that part of it. But you'll hear often, if you read anything in muscle, Hill models and Huxley models. So those are the two most used, because they were right for the most part. With better equipment today, this is still the same. So if you have a contraction that's isometric, and not moving, because one other thing that David Hill, of course, did was he did use the integration to change distance to velocity because of the rate of contraction. So if you have an isometric contraction that's not moving, force is completely different. I didn't solve that correctly at the bottom. I got carried away. Basically, the proof of that whole thing is when you have an isometric contraction and you want to try to measure the force produced when there's a velocity that's zero, isometric force is equal to P.
So
when you have an isometric force with a velocity of movement that's zero, right? That means isometric times zero velocity, your force is equal to your isometric force.
Okay.
Right. So the only time that the forces and the rates are different is when things start to move. This is the standard force-velocity relationship of muscle. Now, I do want to say this. When you ever look at a force-velocity relationship, please be very careful about the units on the axes, because this will also be presented in a way that the velocity is on the y and force is on the x. Right? So some people like to do it that way. So then it'll be tilted, even though it almost looks exactly the same, because it's a hyperbolic curve. This is zero velocity.
this is maximal, called Vmax.
There was a motorcycle back in the 90s called the Vmax, because it was the fastest motorcycle at the time. Sense an aside. It didn't really mean anything at all, did it? So we do know that isometric force, you remember this from your force-length relationship, produces high amounts of force because you have an engagement of cross braces that aren't moving. So he plotted the isometric forces, and then he plotted the forces for anything that was actually a concentric contraction at different rates, how fast the fibers were shortening. And what he got was a curve. With that. Now, one thing you couldn't do, and you can't do, and I can't do, and nobody can do to this very day because it's impossible, is measure Vmax. So you'll notice that the curve I drew stops right there, as opposed to actually becoming zero force. Keep in mind, Vmax is zero force. And the reason why we can't measure Vmax is because there's an inherent viscosity in tissue that everything is always working, if not against a force externally, it'll be working against something internally. So you're always going to have some force produced in these tissues, so you can't really measure Vmax at zero force. So what they do is you take this equation and you fit it, and then you take the math and you go, we predict Vmax is right there. It's a predictive quantity. Because Vmax physiologically, I don't know if it really means anything, because it doesn't really exist per se. Right? But it's a number, and people like numbers. Quantity. Now that would be for, let's call this a, trying to make a connection now back to what it was before last week with our conversation about fiber typing and stuff and how force velocity, etc., and cross-bridge kinetics and fiber typing, they're related, but the exact method by which they're related, nobody's really certain, right? So we do know that there are rate-limiting steps somewhere along the way in these cross-bridge cycles, as Dr. Campbell said, but it could be any of them at any time. Lim and Taylor referred to it as the hydrolysis of ATP. He said that was a rate-limiting step in 1971. So if that's the case, that gives myosin heavy chains a role in the force-velocity relationship, because they're the ones that are going to be hydrolyzing ATP, right? So let's call this one right here a fast fiber. The difference between a fast fiber or a fast muscle and a slow one in the experimental procedures in the literature is thus. I'm going to make it a little bit more exaggerated for effect, which is I'm going to make that curve even greater. And uglier, apparently, than I did before. All right? So what you'll notice are hopefully a couple of things. Right? At any given velocity of shortening, a fast switch fiber produces more force. And that's good to know, because we think fast switch fibers are important for function, for athleticism, for power, those types of things, right? So for any given velocity of shortening, a fast switch fiber produces more force. A velocity of x. Fast, slow, right? Fast is well above the slow fiber with force production. You'll also notice that the maximal contractile velocity is much greater for the fast fiber compared to slow. And that's fine, because they just don't do things as fast at the cellular level as fast fibers do. So So when you're talking about cross-bridge kinetics, you're talking about grabbing and letting go, grabbing and letting go, grabbing and letting go. And in between that, you're pulling to produce some force. Imagine you're on the skull team for Georgetown, and you're out there at 5 o'clock in the morning, rowing ever so quietly across the river, which is a beautiful thing to see. And you're the guy that keeps leaving his oars in the water every time somebody else is trying to scull, and you're slowing everybody down. Well, you're the slow twitch fiber of the equation at that point in time. Because you're not as fast as getting your oar in the water and pulling, oar in the water and pulling, as everybody else is, so you are the weak link in the chain. And when you have a system that's a series of contractile elements, you're only going to be as fast as the slowest one. And slow muscle fibers are not as fast as producing force and cycling their cross bridges as fast twitch fibers are. You can argue about which one's the rate limiting step of that equation. Is it detachment? Is it attachment? Is it swiveling? Is it ATP hydrolysis? Sucker Campbell said it could be any of them. Lim and Taylor say it's hydrolysis of ATP. If you have to pick one, that's a good one to remember. But if you talk about that on an exam, it's argumentative because nobody really knows. And that's what I was going to say earlier, too, with Davis's comment in the beginning. That's why, I can't remember if I said this in the beginning, if we had our way, we'd give oral exams to everybody. Because I think in academia, especially for defenses, et cetera, it's the best way to get to know what people know. Because there are many different answers to questions. Hard to put it all on paper, though, when you don't want to ramble. I get that. I ramble. I'm doing it right now. What you'll also notice is the slope of this line, the curvature, is greater in a slow twitch muscle fiber. This also happens when you fatigue a muscle. Because this curvature is related to A, divided by isometric force. The curvature of this line is A over P naught. And because that's the slope of your line, because it's the slope of rate of heat production to force, so rate of heat production to distance shortened, A is going to go down with time. And that's going to change the curvature of your relationship. So slow twitch muscle fibers, because they do things differently, have a greater curvature of their relationship. This right here, though, I'll write this. Change for fast, fast slow. I'll write that. John Faulkner would be happy. Doug Syme would not. Depending on your area of research, you may agree that isometric force production in muscle of the same size, cross-sectional area, is the same between fast and slow twitch muscle fibers. That's why you'll notice that I have the two hyperbolic curves of the fast and slow muscle fiber creating the same exact isometric force. That is for a muscle fiber, fast and slow, that has the same cross-sectional area. So normalized force is the same. Because when forces start to change based on fiber typing is when cross bridges start to cycle more, because then it has an influence when movement takes place. Not as much when you have that small rate of heat production, which is a few cross bridges cycling, the rate at which they can do it isn't as important until it starts to shorten. So isometric force, generally considered to be the same mechanically between fast and slow fibers, as long as they are the same cross-sectional area, fast and slow. Does everybody understand why? Because I'm going to make sure we have that straight as well. It's important. Because hypertrophy is hypertrophy. But hypertrophy isn't always just getting all more cross bridges in parallel. Hypertrophy can be multiple different things in muscle architecture, and they all have different influences on function. Anybody ever take two batteries and put them in series? Three batteries in series, four batteries in series? Anybody have a flashlight that's a mag light that takes four D-cell batteries? You put them in series. You put those in series, it improves your amperage. you take batteries, you want to, let's say the zombie apocalypse shows up, and you're going to go up to the woods, and you're going to live there happily ever after with your M16, a whole bunch of barbed wire, living off the land, killing zombies. You need to find a way to produce some power because you want to watch your favorite soaps that you recorded on VHS back in the 80s, right? But you can't run your TV because there's no infrastructure anymore because the zombies took over. So you have a whole bunch of car batteries. How are you going to take a 12-volt battery and get 120 volts out of it? You put them in parallel. You take your batteries, you put them in parallel, which means instead of organizing your batteries in series, you put your batteries in parallel. So here, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive. Here, so on, and you add up your voltage so you can turn on a television set during the zombie apocalypse. You can't watch anything unless you have VHS tapes and you can put that into. Same thing happens mechanically in all structures. So the reason why I use that analogy is because everybody likes zombies, and secondly, is because when you take muscle cross bridges and you have a myosin here with a cross bridge, myosin here with a cross bridge, myosin here with a cross bridge, in muscle, all hopefully going to be communicating with an action-producing force, those forces are additive. Right? So if this one here produces 5 newtons of force, which is arguably the force of a cross bridge, 5 newtons, 5 newtons, 5 newtons, then we can say if a muscle had those 4 myosin filaments with actin and those 4 cross bridges were producing force at the same time, we could predict it would produce 20 newtons of force. That's why we know that 25 newtons per square centimeter, that's right, is the usual specific force of skeletal muscle, right? Is that what it is usually? 25 newtons per square centimeter? There's always different units being produced for specific force, right? But there is a range of skeletal muscle specific force that people always use to know if it's diseased, healthy, or otherwise. That's mechanically because if you're talking about PCSA, which is the number of cross bridges in parallel. So if you know that, mathematically, it adds up to be a number. And you can compare across all tissues to see if they're diseased, healthy, aged, or otherwise. Because that's the mechanical result of parallel arrangement of force producing structures.
You add them in series, you increase excursion, right?
Yep, exactly. If you put these sarcomeres in series, like these batteries, this has, so these all have force that are additive. Let's say this sarcomere, make the sarcomeres now, so batteries. Let's say this one contracts at one fiber length per second. Let's say you know that when your sarcomeres contract at a given load, they will shorten at a rate that the fiber itself shortens at a rate of one fiber length per second. And each one of those sarcomeres is doing that. Well, if you have 3 sarcomeres shortening at one fiber length per second, you've got 3 fiber lengths per second. If you have 10, it's 10 fiber lengths per second. So velocity, mechanically, is additive when things are in series. Force is additive when things are in parallel. So if you have a muscle fiber, a muscle that is very large in cross-section, that's going to be high force, isometrically, and probably concentrically, depending on its typing and what it can do. If you have a fiber that's very long, high velocity, small force, because the cross-sectional area here is much less than that. So muscle architecture. You want to compare the sartorius muscle, the longest muscle in your body, it's only about that big around, to the vastus lateralis of your quadricep, which is this big around, but not nearly as long. One's designed for high force, the other one's designed for excursion velocity, and that's how they work together.
Questions? This might be a silly question. What's the difference between excursion and velocity?
excursion can be thought of more often, they use it more often when you talk about passive strain stretch. So if you have more of these series structures in a row, they can each one of them has an ability to go from, let's say, 3 micrometers to 1.5 micrometers. If you put 100 of them in a row, you have 300 micrometers, you can stretch it. If they can only go 2, you can only go 200 micrometers. And that's the excursion of the 2. You can also do an active excursion, too, which is when you have an eccentric contraction and such. Okay. How fast it changes length becomes velocity. Agree? Alright. And if for some reason it becomes more muddled over the course of the next few days, please let me know and we'll talk about it more, because I think trying to apply basic science from a basement in England to you moving tomorrow or right now is relevant and fun.